This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
Welcome to the Talking Earth. I'm honored tonight to have two, acclaimed, what's the other word? Help me, Kim Stafford, what's the other word?
Insufferable. Annoying.
Yeah, we're going to be a little wild tonight because, okay, and then Matthew Dickman, you help me.
Acclaimed.
You're lionized. No, he's lionized.
Meow.
He and his twin brother are... The cats? No, they're not. No, they're tearing up the world. But anyway, we Kim Stafford, a memoir about his brother Brett, a year older, and the name of the book is I've got it. 100 tricks.
Every weird. Boy can do.
I know it's such a weird title. I've rewrote it in my mind, but you know it's a beautiful book, and it's mainly prose. There's more to say about Kim Stafford. I mean, his father was Bill, and this is a very autobiographical book. And I loved your collection of poems. What, a gypsy? What was it?
A Gypsy's History of the World.
I love that. You had those gypsy markings on the back. And then you've done Having It All Right, I don't know, or All
Having
Wrong.
Everything Right.
Having Everything All Wrong, or Right.
Yeah, and my friends say, so do you have everything right? I said, no, I just wrote the book.
Okay. Well, you know, I thought that was a little bit of hubris there.
A little over the top, yeah. I was young, Walt. Forgive me.
Can we hear him well? Okay. And then Matthew Dickman has a twin brother, Michael, which I do not know is writing. This new book, Mayakovsky's Revolver. That's and Matthew, you've won so many prizes. Just give us a couple. wait, give us a couple. Come on.
I can't even remember now. I won an inaugural Mace Sarton Award from the American Academy of Arts and Sciences.
Oh my God, this is disgusting.
And Kate Tufts Discovery Award.
Do they give you money with this? I mean, do you get a vacation and TV?
You actually have, you Walt, you have to pay them.
Oh, you have to pay them. But oh, you've done more than that. You had an Oregon Book Award, and you've done much more than that. And you had actually an earlier collection called All American Poem. Mm-hmm. And I've read the New Yorker article, 8 pages. It was. I'll bring that out. I'll trot that out in a minute. But let's not worry about that. But Matthew, your new book is Mayakovsky's Revolver, and this show is not going to be a downer or a bummer. Both of these poets, authors, who they loved their brother, they love family, they love brother values. So it was a little shocking to me. It came up as a weird idea, and I'm going to ask you, Kim, in a minute here. It was a weird idea that both of these really interesting and vital poets, and your styles are totally different. I'm just going to emphasize that, totally different. But that you had lost older brothers, or you know, in Adrian Hall and Brett. But you know, what shocked me a little bit is, and I thought they should come on, and then Kim first agreed, and then Matthew agreed. So, Kim, why did you agree so much about this? Okay, go ahead.
Well, you know, when I had to write this book, so you have this you have this silence in your life. A lot of people around you, they don't want to talk about the departed one. And so you want to be kind. You don't want people to feel uncomfortable, so you don't talk about it. And, you know, in my case, that went on for 24 years. And finally, I realized this is not working for me. And so I had to write the book. But then I said to my editor, well, I had to write this, but does anyone have to read this? This is heavy stuff.
Right.
You know,
yeah.
I don't want to inflict it on anyone.
Right.
And she said, you know, everyone who's been on Earth for a while has been touched by something mm-hmm. like this, or they will be. So I've sort of leaned forward, Walt, and I want to read this because I found it enables others to, you know, after a reading, people come up to me and quietly say, you know, I had a brother, I had an uncle, I had a father. You know, one person said, you tell my sorrow, though our stories are not the same, you know. So there's a kind of collaboration in this, I think. Mm-hmm. It's something you carry alone, but then when you put it out in a book, others come forward and say, you're not alone. Mm-hmm. So I don't want to be alone, so it's good to be here with you and with Matthew.
Mm-hmm. Well, we're gonna go to Matthew now. But your brother was 40. Brett was 40 years old.
Okay? That's right. Which I think is a tough passage for a man. You know, have you made it? Have you succeeded? Do you know your way in the world?
So are you, maybe, probably. But you know what? Your brother Brett was only a year older than you.
That's correct.
And in a way, you took on the mantle of your very famous father, Bill Stafford, William Stafford, and you say nice things about him, but you also say things like that he couldn't deal with it. Your family really couldn't deal with the loss of Brett, and so the 100 tricks here are little memories, and I heard you on D.May Roberts, and I love her show, Stage and Studio. But you know, you have 100 little memories. You have a great recall, Kim Stafford. You have great recall, and that's part of your book. You know, is this recall?
Well, before we turn to Matthew, I just want to say it's natural not being able to deal with it. I mean, I don't blame my father at all. He was just knocked flat mm-hmm. by the death of his son, and I don't question that.
And that was a gun, wasn't it?
Yes,
it was a gun. Matthew, why don't you talk about your book? And of course, Mayakovsky's Revolver, the great Russian poet, committed suicide at 36, as you say, and then, but you lost, was it Adrian Hull?
Darren Hull.
And he was 6 years older than you, and, mm-hmm. and he was, what was he, the... son of
my father,
a family, mm-hmm. Of your father.
Yeah.
Oh, of your father. Okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I wanted to get this clear.
Yeah.
You have notes in the back of, but actually, you both of you had been. I mean, you and Michael had been close to.
Yeah. Absolutely. You know.
You talk about it, please.
A lot of our immediate family, you know, the siblings, all shared a mother or a father, and although my twin brother Michael and my little sister Elizabeth and I were raised in one household, and our older brothers Darren and Dana were raised in another, Darren and Dana, you know, babysat us all the time, took care of us, and of course Darren was one of the first men that I met who was in my life and did all those things that an older brother, you know, does. And we were close. And
you have a whole section in your book about your notes on your brother, and there's 13 poems.
Yeah, there's 13 poems, all, you know, coming together as kind of as an elegy for him.
I hope you'd read a few of those, but really, talk a little more about your family, though, please. You guys grew up in Lentz. You and your brother, your twin brother, you grew up in Lentz, and then you had this extended family, and, mm-hmm. and you weren't really rich or anything. You were just...
No, not at all.
I want you to laugh more. I think maybe it'll get me through my faux pas.
We felt rich when we got free lunches in the park near our house. But I mean, of course, like, we were rich in other ways, of course, but...
Well, 82nd up there is kind of a dark now. It's even darker than it was then. And your brother died of an overdose. We're not going to go on too much details, but
No, that's fine. He overdosed
and drugs. You talked. You know, there's a thing. You know, about
mm-hmm. Well, he. You know, Darren.
That kind of culture. Tell me about.
Yeah.
That.
Well, you know, Darren was an addict and dealt with. You know, struggled with addiction for the majority of his life, getting sober and then. And then not being sober, but something also about him, and about a lot of people, I think, who end up committing suicide, is that that he also had this huge empathetic heart. I mean, from a very young age, huge amount of empathy. When he got older, he worked with at-risk youth. And
oh, really? That's interesting. I wanted to know more about him because I don't know as
much. He was great with kids. I mean, he was great with Michael and I growing up, but he's, you know, absolutely great with kids and working with, you know, kids who were struggling with some of the same things that he had been struggling with his whole life.
Well, I don't think we need to go totally sociological, but you know, actually, maybe they're so sensitive to everything that the world just gets too painful and they just can't. They have to hide from their. I mean, empathy it can be a problem. I mean, it sounds beautiful, but you're taking on everyone's pain. Yeah. And actually, Kim, your brother got into that, didn't he? Didn't Brett a little bit?
Yeah, one of my brother's friends said to me recently, "Your brother should have been a holy man, not a land use planner." You know, that the tussle of the world is too much for certain people.
And I think there's a certain kind of, I think, healthy empathy.
You guys talk a little bit together.
You know, so Kim, so there's a certain kind of healthy empathy. And then there's a kind of extreme empathy where I think the person can't see the division of himself and another. I mean, that takes on so much and internalizes so much that is, you know, not something they have to do.
Yeah, Thomas Merton says the greatest, the foundation of violence is to think you can save other people without taking care of yourself.
Oh, right. My God.
And, you know, you go over the top, and pretty soon you're crazy.
Yeah, right.
So compassion for oneself has to be part of the formula, and some very good people don't get that balance right.
Right. And I wanted to ask you or maybe talk about this for a moment. You know, when somebody in a family commits suicide, it is such a different kind of reaction to the death than any other death that can happen, whether it's accident, old age. And I wonder about that. I think there's so much still shame, a number of things, shame, embarrassment. Suicide is a kind of violence. So sometimes not being able to understand the capability of that family or member or friend to enact any sort of violence. And then, you know, you see that it has happened.
I was really caught by surprise, Matthew. A few weeks ago, you know, Barry Lopez had that piece in Harper's about his abuse when he was young. And when he was on Terry Gross, he was really struggling with that and saying that he felt shame.
Yeah.
And so I called him up and I got his answering machine and I started, you know, sort of big brotherly saying, you know, you shouldn't feel ashamed and so on. And I just started sobbing on the phone. Mm-hmm. And I thought, I realized I have shame over my brother's suicide, which is a crazy thing. And my brother's daughter, bless her heart, she wrote to me and said, you know, in your book, you seem to think you could have saved him.
Right.
Uncle Kim, you couldn't have saved him. He was on a path.
Yeah.
But still, he was my brother. So, those bits of wisdom don't always stick.
Well, no. Just to interject for a minute, I think sometimes when something like this happens, you feel guilty. I mean, they make you feel guilty. I'm going to make a point here by killing myself that you didn't, whatever, help me. I mean, this is sociological.
Well, I don't think, I actually think that people who actually go through a suicide are engaged in a kind of depression, a kind of pain.
Yes, they're in pain.
That is not only emotional, but actually I think it's physical for them. And the majority of suicides, I don't think are about making any other point but relieving the suffering of the self. Yeah.
You know, it's a strange thing if you don't hurt that much. Tonight on The Talking Earth, Walt Curtis, I have Matthew Dickman and Kim Stafford, and we're going to go, and they're going to read here too, but we want to talk about this. But KBO 90.7 FM Portland. But Kim, back to you. I mean, that one section, I read your book very carefully, and I've done my homework, and it was intense. But the point is, you said your brother was confused. He was out of control. And you said even from the beginning, throughout your book, 100, let's repeat that.
100 tricks every boy can do, how my brother disappeared.
But even when in the beginning, he was talking about.
Yeah, you know, I have to.
Well, in the beginning, he was talking about it.
Yeah, I have to step back from this whole conversation. And, you know, I've written a book, Matthew's written a book, many people try to figure it out, try to go back through it. You know, what did I say? What did I not say? What did I not see? And you try to, in a way, make a case against yourself for this thing that happened. And the fact is, with my brother, it was chemical. Mm-hmm. He was depressed. He got the wrong kind of antidepressants. He stopped sleeping.
Okay.
You know, when you stop sleeping, strange things are going to happen.
You go crazy, yeah.
So, there's a kind of an avalanche begins that is very difficult to pull out of. And I had this experience where I one time I was asking myself, you know, speaking to my brother and my mind, why did you have to go? Why did you have to go? And it was as if there was this little switch in my brain, and those words shifted to, you had to go.
Mm-hmm, right.
You had to go.
Yeah,
at the end of the book, you have the next life. And, one of the things about this conversation is you guys have so interiorized or put these people back, they would have been forgotten. You know, that's what I think writing is about, is some... how not to let something be dissolved into the what, the ether or whatever, it goes away. So you both, this intimacy, you know, Kim, your brother died in what,
1988.
Yeah, 88. It's a while ago, 12 and 13, it's 25 years. And then your brother died about 5 years ago, is
about
that?
6 years ago.
Six years ago. But you both are still feeling their presence, and I think both of these books celebrate the love for your brother. You know,
yeah,
I mean, it's amazing. I mean, I had a problem. I slept in the same bed with my brother. We were poor, but we had a line drawn down the mattress. And we were never close. I mean, really. I mean, you know, he used to put boxing gloves on, and he knocked me around a little bit, and, you know, and...
Tough love, Walt.
And one time he jumped on me on the floor, and he called me, I will never forget it, a lesbian's plaything. What the hell? I'm only like, what, 60? Well, maybe you knew something that I didn't know. But anyway, both of your families, actually, you brought it up, Kim. We're gonna read. Why don't you guys get one poem in each poem? Get ready to read something. We want to read too. But Kim, you said you used the word twin. Brett was like a twin to you.
Yeah, he was like a twin.
And then he's got a twin over. He's got a twin over here. And what does that mean? I mean, it's actually too close for me. Yeah. I'm glad I don't have a father who was a writer, a famous writer. I'm glad I don't have a brother who I have to deal with all the time.
Yeah, the strange thing is, Walt, you know, your brother, he may have drawn that line down the mattress. He may have insulted you, but he was your brother. You know, there's something deeper than all those, spare me the details, you know, the blood is a powerful thing, and yeah, it's a difficult
thing. Well, talk about blood. I mean, you guys talk about blood. I mean, both of you seem to have twins. I would say, Kim, I'm going to be presumptuous here, Brett is kind of like your twin. I mean, your book is so involved with, engaged with this human being for so long. It's amazing to me.
Yeah.
And then the New Yorker article about Michael and Matthew... The closeness of their relationship, and Matthew doesn't want to ever lose Michael. He doesn't know whether he can go on. At the end of his book, you know, he has this thing. But I don't know. I don't know if I'd want somebody that close to me in my family.
Well, it can be a scary thing to be that close to somebody, to be that linked to someone. You know, when I think about my older brother Darren. Of course, so many people, friends and family, suffered over his death, but none as deeply as my older sister, Dana. I mean, speaking of twins, Darren and Dana, a couple years apart, but were absolutely twins.
Twin business. That's interesting, this twin stuff.
Yeah, they were absolutely spiritually connected as twins. And that loss... I mean, that's one of the first things I thought about after the initial shock, which, not surprise, you know, I wasn't surprised that Darren had committed suicide because he had attempted before in his life, but I was still shocked the day I found out. But seeing my older sister and seeing the shell that she was that day, I just thought, I can't imagine my twin dying.
Right, right.
Knowing that that's exactly what she was experiencing right at that moment.
Yeah, you do that long poem at the end of Mayakovsky's Revolver. I kept calling it Pistol in My Deranged Mind, but Revolver. But on Earth, you have, you know, you say you don't really want to live if these people aren't part of your life. And, you know, I that's amazing, you know? I mean, it is grieving. It's very deeply felt.
Yeah, On Earth is the sort of countersong to a lot of the poems in the book. A kind of hope that, for me to exist on Earth, I need these people to exist as well.
Matthew Dukeman. Okay, should we read a poem or two? But
sure.
what did you choose? I had some things, but it's not about me. Kim, where do you want to go? Why don't you start one, and then we want to read a little bit. I mean, this whole hour will just disappear, and we're at 25 minutes or 24 minutes gone. And so where do you want to go, Kim?
Well, here's a passage.
I want to hear your voice.
Here's a passage toward the end of the book. but it touches on what Matthew was just saying. So we had this book when we were little kids called 50 Famous Stories that our parents would read to us. And, you know, I look back at them now, and they're full of these, as my father would say, trenchant moral tales. You know, tough stuff in there, especially this one. So it gets into this passage at the end of the book. In one of the 50 famous stories from our childhood, the Spartan youth, forbidden to have a pet, hid a fox pup inside his cloak. A swaggering superior grilled him about it, but the boy said nothing, did not deny, did not reveal. And all the while, the fox cub gnawed his vitals. I remembered those words. Gnawed his life, his manhood, his core being. And since my brother's death, I have seen a quiet contortion on many faces. So it is for anyone who tries to trap a difficult sorrow, to hold it close, to keep hidden the rage of a hard story. Some around me seem to stop breathing when Brett's name comes up. As a friend said to me, with such grief, it's as if you're supposed to hold your breath and get used to it. It's as if the death means the loving has to stop. But when the courier brings the darkest possible news to Macduff and cannot speak hard things, Shakespeare tells us all, give sorrow words. The grief that does not speak whispers the o'er-fraught heart and bids it break. Give sorrow words. With words, stories spoken, the love, in fact, goes on. My brother kept silent in his pain and broke. We must not do so. Since my brother died, we have never been apart.
You know, that's amazing. And at the end of your book, 100 tricks every boy can do. Okay, I can say this eventually, but you bring him back. I mean, he's still with you. I mean, this is an amazing type of love story. I mean, it's amazing, and he's still with you. You dream about him. I mean, isn't that what you say at the end of the book? And I want you to read some of that too.
Yeah.
Well, but Matthew, where do you want to go? Where do you want to enter into this?
Thinking about that incredible line about once my brother died, we were never apart. I mean, when Darren was alive, we were together and we were apart at times. And it's so true that since he's been dead, we've been never apart, ever apart. I thought that I would start with a poem that has to do with, for me anyway, with that sort of space of wanting the dead brother back, and also has to do with that very surreal space of dealing with someone's death within the family. And it's called it's a poem called Satellite. I'm sitting beneath the bent live oak, wishing the plane blinking above me was a satellite that would shoot images of my older brother back down into my brain so I could print them out and paste them on the wall. I have to keep looking at this one picture of him to remember how his jaw was and which side of the moon he parted his hair. He's always away from me now. Some animal or constellation that walked out of the world but for rumors and half-skeletons found in the Congo, drawings of what he might have looked like. My brain dreams about cities from outer space, a place with a name like Kilimanjaro, where he might still be walking around in his vision streetwear high tops. Or even a shadow, like my father, who talked about Costco the night of my brother's cremation, and how pumpkin-y the pumpkin pie was. Though he bought it in a frozen pack of 20. Just like a real bakery, he said. You just throw it in the oven. He kept saying that. You just throw it in the oven. You just throw it in the oven.
Do one more, because, do one more, and then he's going to do one. But what's Mozart on the Moon? Where is that? On page 115, Kim? Mozart on the Moon, Kim. Well, but go ahead, Matthew. Give us more. I've never heard Matthew read poetry, so I'm kind of interesting how it's okay. Interesting to me how it voice, because this is a spoken word program.
All right. So this is.
I like your brother's grave, but I'll wait. Where do you want to go?
Yeah, I was going to go to my brother's grave.
Okay, let's do that. I think it's great because you know you're kind of transgressive, and actually he's transgressive. Kim is transgressive, and throughout his book, I love you being transgressive. It might have saved your life. Yeah, Kim put himself in the car and was trying to freeze to death, and he said, "Screw it, I'm not going to freeze to death."
You know, my parents' joke before we were born was they were going to have two kids and name them Flawless and Lawless. And I was clearly the second.
Kim, I'm so proud of you because throughout your book, you have this little transgressions. Okay, I do well. Okay, but go ahead. Talk about your growth. But you know what I like about your work, Matthew, is you have these wonderful metaphors, these chain list of or the list laundry list of metaphors, and then suddenly you say some weird thing about. that's sexy or erotic or really almost risque, and then you pop it in there, and then everyone's satisfied.
Man,
so at the end of this poem, you do that, don't you?
Okay, yeah, and this poem, just really quickly, this might be like something we were talking about earlier in a way about this. Questions about like what could I have done? Why wasn't I there? What?
Yeah.
And I think one of the kind of acute and particular things about suicides, at least in my experience with my brother and with other friends, is that one of the difficult things to realize, especially if it's someone you have such an immediate and intimate relationship with, is that it was their moment that had nothing to do with you, that you don't get to be a part. I mean, that's such like a difficult thing. And then, of course, once someone is gone, once someone has committed suicide.
Well, they're gone.
They're gone. Yeah, they're gone. And there's a closeness like we talked about, but then there's the obvious things of it being untouchable. And perhaps this is sort of about relinquishing power for my brother to be dead. My brother's grave. Like a city I've always hated. Driving through but never stopping, my foot on the gas, running all the lights, wishing I were home, hating even the children who live there as if they had a choice. I imagine him in his 10 million particles of ash, tied up into a beautiful white bundle of lace, a silver bow looped where his neck should be, thrown into a washing machine, set on a delicate cycle to spin forever under the dirt. The all of him left, the vegetation of him, the no more thing of him, his skateboard and mountain bike and beers and cigarettes and daughter and mixtapes and loneliness, his legs and feet and arms and brain and kneecaps. Outside the graveyard, there is still some part of him buried in the mysticism of his DNA, smeared across a doorknob or brushed along the jagged edge of his car keys. Two kids from the high school nearby will fuck each other on top of him. And I won't know how to stop them. Someone will throw an empty bottle of vodka over their shoulder, and he will have to catch it.
You know, I love what you do with that, you know, kind of thing. And you grew up in this almost white trash neighborhood up there.
Almost.
Yeah, almost, or was it? Yeah. It's interesting, though, because it's a little different from Kim's background. I'm not saying Kim didn't grow up poor. I mean, I want to talk about Kim's background because his book is so much full of autobiography. But you know, that's... it's throwing a strange, almost surreal reality because reality is surreal. And you know, death... Death highlights all of our vulnerability, all of us, even in this room right now. We don't know what's going to happen or what's going to happen next or who we're going to lose next and then what does that mean? So being alive, so alert, Matthew, I want to give you a big compliment because your poems are so sensual and alive and vital, and I really
Thanks.
Appreciate that.
Yeah, I just want to say, I think Matthew's poetry has a way of being very tough with tender things.
Oh, God.
I mean, that whole thing about the ash and the smear of the DNA, and you know, these is beautiful, delicate. Just that word delicate, and that it resides as a switch on the washing machine. You know, it's a real thing. It's not made. It's not a poetic thing. It's a real part of the mechanical world, and yet the way you bring those things into a great tenderness for your brother. And I think your brother's passing must have contributed to your ability to do that.
Yeah, I think, well, absolutely. And I think there's, of course, so many different ways to write about grief or to write about the difficult thing. You know, one is, in a lot of these poems, for me, a kind of, in a way, maybe a smallish sort of surrealness, you know, coming through with the images. Another way with the memoirs that you've written, Kim, is to name the thing exactly. That the thing is so difficult that you're looking at that metaphor. There's no room for metaphor anymore. There's, I mean, you know that great Pablo Neruda line, which I mention a lot to people when talking about grief or writing about it, when Neruda said that the streets ran with the blood of children like the blood of children. Mm-hmm. You know, there was no more room for metaphor, no more room for simile. And when you write about your family, and in particular in the parts about your family that are difficult, it's like that line. It's looking clear-eyed at the thing and naming it.
Well, in this way, you know, to lose someone very close to you, the hypocrisy evaporates. I mean, you're no longer capable of subterfuge. You're no longer capable of calculation and maybe even reticence. And so I think that's a strange word to use, but that's a kind of a bonus that comes out of trauma like this. You become a truth teller.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you're either going to become silent or you're going to become a truth teller.
Yeah.
And I think you really have in your poems. So thank you.
Thank you.
I have 165 here. Suicide Remarks, great passage. Path to the Sun. But we don't have to do that. Where do you want to go, Kim?
I wanted to read Path to the Sun.
Well, that's why.
We're on the same synchronicity here.
Okay.
Well, this is the beginning of the fourth section of the book, and a vision I had, you know, the first of several. The day my brother took his life, as evening came, we were gathered at my sister Barb's house in Portland, and my sisters and I decided to sleep on the floor, three in a row. Our brother was gone. How could we deserve comfort? As I closed my eyes in my mind, I abruptly saw my brother on a path in the mountains. He was beyond me, above me, where the trail led through the trees toward the ridge. His steps slowed, and he turned to face me. Without a word, his gaze begged me to call him back. But in this trance, with my eyes, I willed him to go on. With one last look over his shoulder, he turned and started up the path. He reached the ridge and disappeared into the rising sun. When I looked down to the path at my feet, it was pulled away like a rope. I was alone in the forest. And I've thought about that often, that sense of willing him to go on. Which is a very strange thing. I mean, one of the things I love in your book, Matthew, I will take you back any way you want. You know, there is that magnetic, like, isn't the moon want to be in touch with the earth? And, you know, isn't this the physics of connection? And yet, you know, this person, their life belongs to them.
That's right.
Yeah, you're not in charge of another person's life.
No. Living or dead.
Well, Kim, your book is so interesting to me. We're not exactly the same age. We're close, probably. But anyway, all of this. This book, 100 Tricks, is not Every Boy Can Do. It's fun. It's autobiographical. A lot of you are in there, you know, and the little things you did. You climb into the tree and Bill had a poem about climbing in the tree, and you went up on a ridge, and you crept out at night, and I love the sagebrush going out, and then and your brother driving down to Southeast Oregon. I mean, I'm an Oregon kind of guy in the old days. I'm trapped in the city now, but in the old days, we just took a car and we drove 500 miles, and you did that with your brother, and he is with the Forestry Service, and he was with the firefighters. It shocks me that he would actually still continue on his quest to die, or whatever you want to call it, because he was a firefighter. He had so much vitality, and he loved the landscape. And your entire family, your father Bill, and yourself, you really know the Oregon landscape, and a lot of that is in this book. So this book is not a bummer at all. In fact, it's very revealing about you. It seems to me that you're getting out under the shadow of your father a little bit. And
you know, well, all that glory of life is true, and I think what Matthew and I have both been talking about you know, when someone gets on a path of depression, that's not available. Those things aren't available. Right. You have a line, you know, talking about yourself, until my body is done punishing itself for punishing itself. You know, there's a kind of no exit cycle.
Right.
That the psyche can enter into, and you can say to that psyche, but it's beautiful.
Right.
You know, it's okay. Well, you don't have the power to say it's okay to another person.
No, you don't. And, you know, along those lines, this is a very, like, overly simplistic thing maybe to say, but it's something I've said to people when talking about suicide, and people who are like, well, I just don't get it. You know, I just don't know why your brother would commit suicide. I don't know why. So especially if it is someone, and it often is, who has vitality, who's a fireman or who works with kids.
Oh, yeah.
And something that I talk about, at least in regards with my own brother, is that, you know, our bodies want nothing more but to live. And the sort of simple example is that if I walk into the kitchen and grab the handle of a pan on the stove, and it's been on, and it's hot, I don't even have to think about it. I grab the handle, my hand lets go. Now, my older brother, Darren, was someone who, you know, psychically speaking, could grab that handle and then decide whether to let go or not. Mm. Right?
Yeah.
Matthew, get something. Yeah, we don't want to take a call, I don't think. But Matthew, get another poem. And,
oh,
and,
sure.
And, while you're looking, just I love this line.
You talked about him.
His body, which by then was all electricity and chemical halos. You know, just that's another dimension. I think my brother's pain crescendoed to a point where he had to depart.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Yeah. You know, again, a very tiny, tiny thing, but and very distant, of course, from suicide. But trying to understand suffering, trying to understand physical pain. You know, if you're like me, you're terrified of the dentist, terrified. But if I have a tooth abscess, I will go running towards it. I would pull it out with pliers just to be okay. Well, I'll read, since Kim brought it up, I'll read, and also because we're both, you know, Portlanders, I'll read this poem, West Hills. My older brother is in heaven above the West Hills, swimming in a swimming pool, behind a big house built on the side of a hill on stilts so it won't go crashing down into the long boulevard below it, built that way so the house won't jump, won't one day decide it's over, nothing left, the dark from the evergreen trees making it all seem like closets and midnight. My brother on his back looking up at the sky. He's full of cocaine and Heineken. There's no telling him apart from the sun or the sky or the shining stars his hands make, the water falling from his fingers back into the wet body of the pool. Whenever I drive up here through the black curves, I wonder which house it is. Which one became a kind of vacation for his heart? What the bathroom looks like? Whose bottle of Vicodin he carried between the soft skin of his waist and the elastic band of his swim trunks? If that person was a woman, if she was beautiful, if later she pulled him, soaking, past the leather furniture, past the mirrors and Chinese vases throwing up their long silvery petals, into the bedroom, and then knelt down in front of his body, which by then was all electricity and chemical halos. If she took his shorts by the waist or by the pockets, if she knew he was already stuffing his wrists with razors like strange envelopes, or building the pyramids of pills that would take him to Tutankhamun, that he was planning his new kingdom, if she listened to his breathing all night, or if she knew his name.
You have, I think people need to know how rich these books are, but I like the crazy poem Weird Science, but we got a couple more. Now we're at 15 minutes now. We're doing fine. I mean, see how fast the show goes. But Kim, and I like the two of you talking together, but Kim, we got to get your voice on here. What are you going to read? Why don't you read something positive about your brother? One of the kids. I mean, one of the kid things. When you were kids, you had a fort, and what are some of the things that you did when you were What are they? I'm going to read some of the
Okay, time. Well, I can't find the passage, but let me just tell the story.
Great.
So by some fluke,
yeah.
I got into the advanced math group in high school. It was a terrible mistake.
Yeah.
I remember very clearly going to my teacher in eighth grade, and I was to divide, you know, how do you remember these things? I was to divide 19 into 57.
Oh, my God.
And it must have been late in the day, but I went to the teacher and I said, I tried 4 and I tried 2. And she said, try 3. You know, so that was my level. But somehow,
I know what you mean.
I got in this advanced math thing. And so my brother and I were in the same math class for the 3 years in high school. And we would sing our homework.
Oh, wow.
We'd have the radio on, top 40, and Ooh. We would be chanting answers. And I wish I could hear it now,
right?
Because we were on a wavelength that was so hilarious, and it was a daily practice. We'd
wow.
be singing algebraic formulas. I can't imagine that now.
That's amazing, yeah.
But I look back, and you know, that's who we were when we were in the same room.
Yeah.
Kim, you were so close to your brother. It's almost like the twin business that he has probably with his brother, you know, Michael. I mean, come on. When my brother and I were small, our mother made a book of photographs positioned in folds of blue construction. Anyway, but you did so many things with your brother. Indian blanket. I'm just using some of the titles. Find one of these. The smartest pet. Okay, the lie. There's no question that I could be a bad boy. Now, what I like about Kim, it's about time he fesses up that he was a bad boy.
Yeah.
In my career, I have participated in shoplifting, lying, deflecting blame onto the innocent, and pretending to light my sister on fire after my friend Van and I had tied her to the tetherball pole in fierce play. I got raked over the coals for that one. It was forbidden to carry matches. No, this is a wonderful thing about you, because our parents were far away. Earl had died. Well, we're not pals. Well, let's not go there. The wanderer. In our family, among the 4 children. But, you know, this is an amazing autobiography. I mean, by getting into your brother, you're actually revealing yourself. But I've never been that close to my brother. I assure you, we both argue on the day I owe my mother a thousand.
Well, you know, we were talking about, Matthew was saying he just met his
Talk
new,
about
brothers, new nephew,
brothers.
You know, tiny little
August,
baby. And,
August Conrad Nobles.
Yeah. And, you know, that's a sobering thing. And I think I wrote this book really for my son. I mean, I have to raise...
Yeah, how is Guthrie? Is Guthrie?
Guthrie's doing great.
Woody Guthrie's.
I have to, you know, my wife and I, we're raising a boy child. And that is a big project.
Yeah.
And so I have to understand this thing about getting along in the world as a man, you know, it's a tough gig.
I think males are vulnerable. I think they're the endangered species. I'm sorry. I know they beat up on their girlfriends and whatever. But
well, just so many things that my brother didn't say because he was a man. Because he was a tender one, but he was a man. He was manly, so he didn't tell us his pain, and that doesn't work very well.
No, it doesn't. And there's. I mean, speaking about gender and being brothers and men, you know, there is, no matter if you grew up in Lentz or if you grew up in the West Hills, there's often a kind of particular contract one is supposed to sign as a young man. Usually that contract is a contract of quietness and violence.
And shutting down your emotions.
And shutting down your emotions, which I think is a kind of psychic violence to the self. And to work against that with our brothers, with our sons, with our fathers, you can teach an old dog new tricks, I think, is an important thing to do, whether you're a writer or a painter or a mathematician like Kim.
Yes. I think that's right. I just keep finding these lines, Matthew, that I love in your poems. I don't have to be in hell if I don't want to be. And I just read that line over and over. I want that to be true. Is that true? Do we have a choice?
No, I think it's hopeful.
Yeah,
I think it's hopeful. I think maybe it's partly emotionally true. Maybe not always physically or chemically true. But I think it's more of a hopeful thing.
You know, I realized one thing I had, and you have. Writing can console.
Yeah.
You know, Langston Hughes said, "When I feel bad, I write so I don't feel worse." I mean, he's not saying so I could solve it,
right?
Or so I'll feel better. You don't have that power, but you can kind of moderate.
Yeah.
And I think I'm so grateful for your book, and I think it will help others. And, you know, we're maybe co-authoring Words of Consolation and accompanying people in hard times.
Well, it's interesting for, you know, a tribe that is writers. I'm surprised that more writers aren't writing about suicide, seeing how that's one of the things that has depleted our numbers, mm-hmm. and continues to deplete our numbers. I'm surprised that people aren't engaged in it more and more openly.
Mm-hmm. Well, especially with veterans, you know, it's a.
Yeah.
Let's go to the mega.
Turners, you know, mm-hmm. saying, you know, the suicide wasn't on the list of casualties, and
right.
this is a crime, and the
right.
story must be told.
Yeah.
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 I really wonder about the next generation, and Matthew, you're older than I thought maybe you were, but it doesn't really matter. You're not that old. But you know, I really wonder, as sensitive and complex as human beings are, they're so sensitive to the world that the future doesn't look very promising, you know? And I'm not saying I'm going to blame myself, or you know, but we want them to have a future, and you know, when you do climate disruption and you multiple wars and you have capitalism, you have all these things and drugs, and you know, you have all of this. When I was young, it was partly because of kind of a gay identity, but you know, I remember Albert Camus' book. Help me, The Myth of Sisyphus, and I really felt, I think many young people probably feel suicidal. Now, Kim, you said you were in your car, you were going to freeze to death, and then you got back in your car, you decided, I don't want to freeze to death.
Yeah, because I was just too curious.
Right.
I mean, curiosity is really what saved me. It wasn't like, I want to be okay. I just want to find out what's going to happen.
Well, that's what Camus says in The Myth of Sisyphus. You think you know what the future is going to be, but you don't know. Something amazing might happen. I mean, love might happen, or you know, or fame, or whatever, or an adventure, or truth. So I wonder, what is the thing that destroys the psyche? The pain. Now, I think some of it is biochemical, though.
You know? Yeah, some of it is.
And particularly if you use various chemicals, mm-hmm. you know, you get into a rut, you know. And I mean, heroin is really a downer. Mm-hmm. You know, it's hard to get away from heroin. I mean, a lot of people have OD'd. And,
right.
And I'm not even sure that was a suicide. Maybe it was an accident. But he was leaning into that. But I mean,
right.
But people are trying to get away from their pain. There was an amazing thing on Democracy Now. KBOO 90.7 KBOO. Democracy Now. You've got to listen to that. But this guy runs a clinic. Mate, what is his first name? Anyway, he's Hungarian, and he said, He allows them to shoot up. They're such pain. Alcoholics and people use substance abuse. They're in such pain. Mm. You know, the Native Americans up there. I mean, they were raped, and you know, it's just a horrific story of their pain. Mm. So when they come to his clinic, there's no judgment. Mm-hmm. And then he has another book called In the Land of Hungry Ghosts, and then he has another book called When the Body Says No. His name is, damn it, Mate is his last name. But, but you know, some of this, you know, maybe they don't do it on purpose. They're just on a track. I mean, it seems like your brother, Matthew, you know, once you get down so far down and your body is hurting for... And why do bodies hurt? Trauma? Whatever. Mm-hmm. Okay.
And it can be physical trauma. It can be psychic trauma.
Psychic trauma. You know, psychic trauma is worse than physical.
Yeah. People could never abuse drugs in their lives, but deal with clinical depression. And walking through the air we walk through can be a painful event.
Well, I want to hear your voice because I've never heard it. And Kim, we only have 4 minutes. Do you want to read something or a little bit, or what about the next life? What do you want to do? Or maybe you just want to comment, Kim Stafford.
I just want to comment. I think one of the dimensions of this program is Matthew and I, and Walt, you too. We're writers. We have access to a form of alchemy that can turn very difficult experiences into stories, into poems. And if I'm a missionary for one thing, it's the importance and the opportunity for someone who's suffering to write their story, put it into words, get with others who want to hear those words. And, you know, Philip Booth says our longing is to turn the ordinary things of our lives into legend. Mm-hmm. And I think, Matthew, you've done that so beautifully in your book, and I've tried to turn my brother's life into a legend.
Mm-hmm. Oh, you have. Kim Stafford, you have 100 tricks every boy can do. God, I don't know. It's too weird for me.
It just rolls off your tongue.
We're not going to do that. Yeah. And then we have Matthew Dickman with... We'll put a little miles on here. Now we have what we got 4 minutes here. Mm-hmm. Okay, but read another poem. But what
I can read a short, quick one.
Well what about torturing your sister Elizabeth?
That's too long.
No, okay. What about the one about the weird science about? Did you make up on the floor a kind of mannequin of your brother? Was that done for your brother or no?
No, that was actually about a woman. But I will read just one quick, little short poem about my brother that is in this elegy set, but it is about imagining another life. It is about...
Well, you have him being in a flying saucer, et cetera. Right. Go ahead.
Okay. More than one life. My older brother is standing outside the movie theater like a man I've never met, standing in the snow, looking up at posters for films that haven't played in over 50 years. In this dream, he's 13 years old, and then he's 30, and then he's nothing. John Wayne is looking down at him, and so is Greta Garbo. Here in New York, Marlene Dietrich is inhaling all the death a close-up can gather in its big, beautiful, hazy arms. My brother's lit a cigarette. He's turning up his collar. He looks like Gary Cooper. He flicks the button to the street like a detective, his long fingers making a shadow across the sidewalk. In this life, nothing inside him wants to pull a knife, load a gun, open a package of painkillers. In this life, he's a day off and is going to see a movie and buy some popcorn and sit in a darkness he can rise from and walk up the aisle like a groom, walk out into the air again and down the street and whistle maybe and go home.
Okay. Matthew Dickman, Mayakovsky's Revolver, Kim Stafford, we're almost done here. Let's turn on the Miles Davis here. But listen, what? Give us quick. Is somebody going to have a reading here soon? Or you've been on NPR. Actually, I understood, Kim. And Matthew, what are you doing? You just flew back and forth? Quick.
I'm heading. I'll be the 13th. I will be at City Lights Bookstore in San Francisco.
Okay.
7 o'clock.
Okay. Say hello to Lawrence Ferlinghetti. Turn up the volume here. Thank you all for being here. Patrick Bocard, my engineer. And why don't we turn up the Miles Davis?
You're listening to KBOO Portland, your community radio station, located on your radio dial at 90.7 FM and online at kboo.fm. Coming up at midnight, the Tiki Cha-Cha Club, followed by Lounge World. But coming up next, stay tuned for Subhuman Intellect Theater, right after this station announcement.
1, 2.
KBOO Radio is proud to help sponsor the Portland Old Time Music Gathering, taking place from January 16th through January 20th at various venues across Portland. The Portland, Oregon Old Time Music Gathering is a grassroots, volunteer-run festival that aims to celebrate and enrich the community of traditional, old-time Appalachian-style string band musicians. A list of performers, locations, and more information can be found at kboo.fm/2013oldtime.
From the KBOO Worldwide Headquarters in Portland, Oregon, it's Subhuman Intellect Theater with your host, Noah Medrano. Tonight's guest, Contessa De La Luna, plus two radio plays written and directed by Kirsten Leiden. And now, live from Limbo, here's Kirsten and Noah!
What?
Who?
What's going on?
Are you there, Noah?
Kirsten?
Where are we?
Where are you?
Where are you? I can hear you, but... I don't know if I can see you.
I can't really see anything.
No, I don't either. But I can hear you. You've got to be close by, right?
This is weird. Why? Who's with you?
Nobody?
I thought I heard another voice.
Well, I've been hearing a lot of voices, but none of them were familiar.
I heard someone say that we're in limbo?
Limbo?